One of the things that has contributed to the difficulties, and here too I think for a while we were slow to recognize how pernicious it really was, had been the development of anti-Semitism in the Arab world. Countries where there may have been a long history of Arab-Jewish coexistence, but where these days there were no or only very tiny Jewish communities, had become a place for the recycling of some of the worst Nazi-style anti-Semitic propaganda in Egypt, elsewhere in North Africa, in Saudi Arabia, in these places. One could find these publications. One could find them in the street, and then one could find them on television and on cable. And even if it had minimal impact on their own society, since there were so few Jews present, it itself became one of those exports to Europe. And with a growing Muslim population in Europe, these anti-Semitic materials found their way now to those communities as well. This contributed, I think, to making it clear to European leaders that one could not simply avoid or dismiss these manifestations of anti-Semitism as somehow just a connection to the diminishing state of the Middle East peace process or Middle East politics. I mean, this was clearly a reflection of anti-Semitism. Several developments have occurred that have, I think, contributed to dealing with this, to confronting this problem, and helping to combat it. The United States comes together with European governments, at least in one international organization, the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Its origin is a Cold War establishment, where it was really, in 1977, created as a way to deal with the Soviet Union, the focus on human rights issues, which included the emigration of Jews from the Soviet Union, and to touch on economic and security matters. Today, the OSCE remains a place to focus on human rights. It conducts election monitoring in many of the countries of Europe and the former Soviet Union. But it was a venue where the US and European governments came together. And so, starting with US pressure, it held the first conference of any international governmental organization focused exclusively on anti-Semitism, which took place in Vienna in 2003. The importance of that conference was itself establishing a place to look at this issue, particularly after what had happened in Durban, without the excess baggage that had taken place at other such gatherings where all manner of racism and intolerance are folded together. What was most significant was, in its own way, the decision that there would be a follow-up conference. A year later, hosted by the government of Germany, opened by the German president. And we are in preparation for that conference. There was drafted a Berlin Declaration. It was something that we worked on quietly and privately. But for the first time, you had a document endorsed by 55 countries that essentially defined the problem of anti-Semitism, acknowledged that it had taken on new forms and manifestations, which was clearly a reference to what was going on with regard to Israel, reference to the demonization, efforts to delegitimize the state of Israel. And it also said explicitly that in no way can events in Israel and the Middle East justify anti-Semitism. It was a turning point because it really began to get governments in Europe to recognize, to acknowledge the problem that was in their midst. And we would say, and from our own lessons working in the United States, that the way you confront the problem of anti-Semitism is to acknowledge it, is to address it, and to get political leadership to take it seriously and to respond to it. And I would add, to recognize, as we have, that it is a form of a hate crime and deserves to be acknowledged and dealt with as a crime would be dealt with. So one of the other elements that came out of that meeting in Berlin was a decision to take the experience of law enforcement, largely that had been adopted in the United States to deal with hate crimes, and try and apply it to different countries in Europe, at least make it available to law enforcement in European countries. And so a law enforcement officers program was established, again, modeled on the United States, but presented and taught by law enforcement officers from the US, from Canada, from the United Kingdom, taking it to different countries within Europe. It goes on to this day, and there are about 20 countries now that have participated in this. These two steps were important, and I think we have seen now over the last several years European leaders acknowledging and speaking directly to the problem. It is, ironically, one could say, a demonstration of both good news and bad news. The fact that President Sarkozy would stand up and speak directly to the problem of anti-Semitism in France, clearly refuting, by the way, the previous government, which tried to somehow rationalize anti-Semitism or rationalize these acts as representing discontent with the political system in the Middle East or events in the Middle East, something that Sarkozy himself has directly and explicitly refuted, is a very important and powerful statement. The fact that he feels the need to do so is, again, I think, a reflection that this is a problem that remains, even if the numbers of incidents themselves in France have in recent years decreased rather dramatically. We heard the same kind of message from German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Only in January of this year, the Bundestag convened its own one-day conference to look at the problem of anti-Semitism, focused primarily inside Germany. And even as we look at the new aspects of anti-Semitism with regard to Israel or with regard to events stemming out of the Arab and Muslim communities in Europe, we recognize, as did Chancellor Merkel, that the old or more traditional fonts for anti-Semitism still exist. Skinheads, neo-Nazis, populist right-wing parties, they may not have large percentage of supporters, but they do garner support, and they do represent still a threat and a problem in these societies. And so when this conference took place in January in the Bundestag, it was opened by the Chancellor, and she herself spoke of the need to be vigilant and her own frustration that this remains still a problem for the German government to confront, for the German government to deal with. As I said, our problems in Central and Eastern Europe may have been masked a bit as these countries sought this membership in NATO and in the European Union, and put themselves, or put forward, perhaps the most positive picture that they could. But we've seen, unfortunately, as these countries have achieved those milestones, that the societies themselves still have not really dealt with, have not fully confronted their respective Holocaust-era histories. And that itself has led to a certain degree of anti-Semitism, particularly as we have worked to press for the restitution of Jewish communal property in these countries to serve as a basis for self-sufficiency on the part of those communities. There has been a backlash, there's been a resentment that we see. And depending on the kind of political leadership or lack thereof, we see very real problems in a number of these places. I mentioned this European Union Monitoring Center. One of the achievements we have seen a couple of years ago has really been in the acknowledgement that they did not have a full and complete definition of anti-Semitism to use in their own work. They were required to monitor the situation in all EU member countries, but even when that number of countries was only 15, it turned out that less than half had any definition of anti-Semitism to work with, and of those that did, no two definitions were alike. And so we worked very quietly, rather privately, with the monitoring center leadership and developed, or saw them develop, a working definition of anti-Semitism. One that could be used and replicated by monitors, by police departments, and others. And one of the, I think, critical and important elements of that definition was, for the first time, it spoke explicitly of how an anti-Israel animus can cross over and become itself a form of anti-Semitism. When the state of Israel is so demonized, when it is held up to a standard that is expected or demanded of no other country, this definition explains, this too is a form of anti-Semitism. When the kind of terms that will be applied, such as calling it a racist state or using Nazi analogies and metaphors, that is a form of anti-Semitism as well. And so while we've heard it in international fora and conferences, for the first time this became an official document of the European Union. These have been some of the elements that I think have allowed us to begin to deal with the problem. If we look at the record of incidents, I think we have seen in most but not all countries a decline in the last couple of years. But it is by no means a problem that has disappeared. And I think, though it is perhaps too early to tell, there's certainly a level of nervousness and anxiety since the fall, with the difficulty in the world economy, with the association of Wall Street and Washington that fit into many traditional stereotypes held by anti-Semites. What we see and what we hear, at least in the margins of these societies, certainly give us reason to be concerned and reason for us to be vigilant. Perhaps when we go downstairs, we can have more of a give and take, and I can answer questions if you have them about this. I'd like to say more, and perhaps do it there too, about attitudes in the Arab world and whether there's something that can be done to change them as well. But for the meantime and for the time in this service, let me thank you for your attention, and again, I look forward to continuing the discussion downstairs. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Baker. We'll be handing out cards and taking questions downstairs during the Onus, so that'll be part of the give and take we'll have afterwards. We turn now to page 282, and we rise for a landing.